51-26. Tonight, the Bucks travel to New Orleans to face the Pelicans, and the Bulls are off. NHL, Blackhawks lost to the Rangers 7-1. They're off tonight. Now the WGTD Monday forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny and cold. Today's high 27. Normal high this time of year 35. This morning, wind west at 8. It is 10 degrees in Racine, 9 degrees in Kenosha. The wind chill at 3 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Before we get to today's morning show, we want to just point out how the calendar is going to work as we approach the holidays. WGTD Studios will be closed this Friday, December 23rd, and that entire following week as well. But that doesn't mean that you can't continue to hear the morning show throughout the period. But what you need to do is subscribe to the podcast version of the program. We will be sharing a morning show interview each and every day that the station is closed, as well as on Saturdays and Sundays, as usual. The podcast is titled The Morning Show with Greg Berg, and it's available through all of the major podcast providers, including Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and Spotify. So I would encourage you, this would be a great time to take care of your subscription to the podcast version of The Morning Show in order to continue to enjoy the program throughout the course of this holiday season. Here we go with today's Monday Morning Show here on WGTD. On today's morning show, we are examining the many and varied miracles that are part of the heart. The human heart, for one, but we also are going to be talking about the heart as it functions in all kinds of other creatures in the world around us. All courtesy of a fascinating book called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. It is the work of one Bill Shutt, who is a vertebrate zoologist and emeritus professor at Long Island University, and also a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History. And there's a chance that you have heard about one of his previous books, which include Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History, and Dark Banquet, Blood and the Curious Lives of Blood-Feeding Creatures. So we see a bit of a through line from those previous books to this latest one published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, again titled Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. And Bill Shutt, we welcome you to the morning show.
It's really great to be there, Greg.
I appreciate you making time for this conversation. So can you explain to our listeners what it is that has drawn you to this particular area of interest, that is, the role of blood in our lives and the role of blood in the animal kingdom, and now in this latest book, that mechanism that pumps blood through the body. What drew you to this particular line of inquiry in the first place?
Well, let's see. I've been studying vampire bats for the past 32 years, and so when I was lucky enough to land my first nonfiction book, I decided to write about creatures that fed on blood. And so the first half of the book was about my research and my family and capturing vampire bats down in places like Trinidad. And so I'm also really interested in history and the history of blood to me and things like transfusions and the fact that, you know, they used to transfuse ale or wine into people when they really didn't understand what blood was. So that became, you know, it was sort of a natural thing for me to write my first book about something that was that had to do with blood, since I was working on blood feeding creatures like vampire bats. And after that, I thought, well, all right, well, this is kind of neat, because I think I've sort of found a niche where I can take a topic that is arguably extremely weird, and demystify it and put a zoological slant on it, and that's what I did with In Dark Banquet, and then I'm looking for a follow up to it, and I just came up with the idea of cannibalism, When I looked at the works that had been done, there really were sort of two piles. One of them was really sensationalized stuff that I was not interested in, a lot of criminal cannibalism and that sort of thing. And on the other side, it was this highly academic work that you'd be interested in if you were a scientist studying specific types of animals. And there was nothing in the middle, so I just kind of cruised right down the center to write a book that was not heavy on scientific jargon, and I was really interested in telling these stories, whether it was vampirism in the animal kingdom and the history of blood or cannibalism, you know, telling them in the way that was entertaining, sometimes humorous. You know, you write a book about cannibalism, you have to sort of pick your spots. But you know, it was neat to sort of find that niche. And after I wrote those two books, and cannibalism was very successful, my agent and my editor at Algonquin suggested that I do something a little bit more mainstream. So I said, well, what do you have in mind? And one of the things that they gave me on this list was the heart. And my knee-jerk reaction to that was, this has to have been done. There's so much written about the heart that, you know, where am I going to find the stories that are weird enough or interesting enough to write the kind of book that I had written before? And so they said, well, just check it out. So I did some research and found that indeed there was a lot of really interesting information about the heart and blood and the circulatory system that hadn't been told. And so I was able to put a book together that I was really happy with, and found a lot of interesting stories, whether they were about different types of hearts and circulatory systems in animals or human history with regard to the heart. But the neat thing about this book was, you know, when you write a book about, you know, when you study vampire bats for 30 years, a lot of times you'll get a response, mostly from your relatives, along the lines of, you know, it sounds interesting, but how is that helping grandma stay alive? And so there's sort of almost an implied lack of relevance there. Hmm. But when I wrote the book about the heart, when I looked into the animal kingdom, I found that some of the most interesting examples in the animal kingdom were clinically relevant, that they were being studied, not because they were neat, but because their biology was able to help help the human condition and help and be involved in human medicine. And I found that time after time, and that just made the book even more interesting to me.
Right. I think I would have been drawn to your book in any event, just because it is exactly the kind of thing I love to look at, and particularly for the purposes of this program. I don't mind mentioning that there's a very personal reason why I was especially eager to speak with you and to explore this book, namely the fact that recently my father-in-law suffered a fairly serious heart attack, and it's the first time anybody in my immediate sphere, either a close family member or close family friend, has ever suffered a heart attack. And I've never really taken much time to explore just what it means when somebody suffers a heart attack. And so I was so anxious to see your book, and I'm really glad that I got to read it. I was very intrigued by the approach that you took, and not just the fact that you venture far and wide through the animal kingdom, but also kind of the light touch with which you write this book. And, of course, that is a hallmark of other things that you have written as well. Is that just the voice that comes most naturally to you, or is it a very conscious choice for you to write this and your other books with that particular voice?
Well, thank you, for one. And for two, I think that it has a lot to do with the fact that I was a teacher for a long time. I was a college professor, plus the fact that I've done quite a bit of amateur acting. And I think that you have to grab an audience, whether it's a bunch of college students or whether it's someone who's reading popular science. And I think that the way to do that is to de-emphasize the jargon. And I'm not trying to show off that I know big words. And try to make it entertaining. Try to write a book about cannibalism, where you can repeat the stories at the dinner table. And I got reviews that said that I had done that. And so I think it comes natural to me. You know, it's really my voice is one that is looking to make it interesting, and to get some major points across. And there are themes that you see that go across all three of my, and now four, nonfiction books. I've just finished a book on the natural history of teeth that should be out next year. I think that's sort of my natural writing voice when I'm writing nonfiction.
I like it very much. Speaking of grabbing your audience, you open your book in rather intriguing, surprising fashion, I should say. I mean, we encounter a beached blue whale, of all things. And you really do a great job of describing this scene. And although at first we're not quite sure why this story is here in this book about the heart, it becomes clear very quickly just how this connects. Explain this remarkable scene that you describe and why you chose to open your book with it.
Yeah, I work at the Museum of Natural History, and I've been a research associate there forever, and I have a lot of friends that work at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. And the curator in charge of that I was most closest with was a guy named Mark Engstrom, and he did a lot of work with whales, and one of the things that he wanted to do was to collect specimens from every type of whale that frequented the Canadian waters. And he and his coworkers would get questions, because they were whale experts, about, you know, what's the largest heart in the world? And he'd go, blue whale heart. Oh, how big is it? It's the size of a car. But in reality, he didn't really know that. He was going by the fact that this was the largest animal on the planet, largest vertebrate on the planet, I should say, and it weighed 90 tons, and so, of course, the heart would be huge. But blue whales, unfortunately for researchers, have a tendency, when they die, to sink. So if you go back to the whaling days, these were, you know, there were whales called the right whales, and these were the whales that didn't sink when you threw a harpoon in them. And that was not the case with blue whales. So researchers didn't really have specimens to examine, except maybe, you know, after they'd gotten torn up by whalers. But he didn't really know how big the heart was. In 2014, sort of a tragedy, 9 blue whales died on the ice in northern Canada, and we think they get caught on an ice floe, and it sort of propped them up. They didn't sink, and when they floated away, 3 of them came ashore in small villages. And they just thought, well, this is a really interesting time to be able to possibly go up and recover a heart of a blue whale and see if it's as large or as interesting as we think it might be. So they sent up a team, and we're talking about construction equipment, because this is a major undertaking. And they found this thing beached in right in front of the only restaurant in town, in this small town in northern Canada, And over the course of the next several weeks, they were able to extract the heart from this creature. And we're talking about lowering two of the scientists down into the cavity to remove the heart, spreading the heart, spreading the ribs with jacks in order to cut this thing out. And the first thing that happens when they do remove this heart and they plop it down on the ground, it doesn't look like a typical mammal heart. You know, if you go to a butcher shop and you see a calf's heart, we've all seen that sort of thing. It has structure to it and shape it, so it sits there. And this thing, when I looked at the pictures of it, it reminded me of of a soup dumpling. It just kind of, you know, squished down. And so that was really weird. And they wondered why that was so. Come to find out that they think that this heart collapses when these whales dive to extreme depths, thousands of feet. And that may be a mechanism where the heart is not really resisting that pressure of that deep dive. So it just collapses. But the other thing that they noticed, and this is, you know, it took 5 years to preserve this thing. They had it plastinated. They wound up sending it to Germany. And you may have seen like some of the exhibits where they take a human body and they plastinate it. And that's what they did with this heart. But it was a lot smaller than they thought it would be. You know, this was a heart that for a 90-ton creature, came in, you know, weighed in at about roughly 400 pounds. And they expected something much, much larger. And they wondered why that was so. And what they determined was, if you were to take a hummingbird, for example, and blow it up and to 90 tons, its heart would be 8 times the size. It would roughly be, you know, 3,200 pounds. And they think that the reason behind this is because hummingbird wings beat at about 80 times per second, and you've got to supply those wing muscles with oxygen and nutrients, and you've got to carry away carbon dioxide and waste products. And so there's this tremendous energy and oxygen demand by those muscles in order to contract so that the wings will beat 80 times per second. And they also determined that if you look at a hummingbird, heart rate is about 1,260 beats per minute. That's 1,260. And we think that that's pretty much the limit that a heart can beat if you look at it as a mechanical device. So the only other way to get more blood to those wing muscles is to have a larger heart. So that's why the hummingbird heart is 8 times larger than a blue whale heart, which beats at about, I don't know, maybe 8-10 times per minute. And there, you don't have that high oxygen demand. So these are all things that they discovered about this creature, who everybody's known about for a long time. And they're still learning new things about it. Hmm. And I just found that incredibly fascinating.
Right. It is interesting. I think one of the most interesting things about the story is the point that you already made about how, for whatever reason, blue whales tend to sink when they die. And because of that, there are certain things about blue whales and their inner anatomy that were largely unknown to scientists. And we just kind of forget that in this age in which we sort of feel like we can know anything about anything we want to know about, that isn't really true. And that there are certain things that for certain reasons become just out of easy reach of our inquiry. And sometimes we have to wait for instance, the unexpected beaching of a blue whale before we can really take a close look at a blue whale's heart and come to understand it better. And it is...
Yeah, you nailed it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And it's a launching pad then for your exploration of all kinds of different hearts. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Bill Shutt about his newest book, which is called Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. One of the things that you say about your book is that you intend it to be the history of our attempts to understand the function of the heart and circulatory story, which is long and until recently riddled with errors. This is a part of the book that I think is exceptionally fascinating, where you look at human beings' understandings and for a long time misunderstandings about the whole nature of the heart. In fact, the second section of your book is titled What We Knew and What We Thought We Knew. And it's a really, really fascinating story, and I should think it was endlessly interesting for you to explore it. One of the things that you tell us is that one of the areas of the ancient world in which they came to at least some correct understanding of the nature of our circulatory system were the ancient Egyptians, to which we owe so much. Explain some of the insights which they apparently had, and to what extent it's difficult for us to actually ascertain exactly what they knew and when they knew it.
Well, the ancient Egyptians in 1555 BCE, there was a book called the Egyptian, became known as the Egyptian Book of the Heart, and in it they may have described heart attacks and aneurysms, but they were really, really interested in the heart. That, for example, they preserved it so that it could be weighed against the feather of Mat, who was the goddess of truth and justice, and she would sort of decide if the owner had lived a virtuous life. And Egyptian medicine was, well, first of all, and they didn't think much of the brain. They just yanked that out of your nose with a hook. And so that it was the heart that they thought was the seat of what we would call emotions and things like that, and intellect. That's where all of that started, that whole idea of cardiocentrism. You know, down through the ages, this gets sort of, this gets magnified by artists and people who write about emotion and love and its connection to the heart. But it really started with the ancient Egyptians. And their medical information was flawed, to say the least, even though they did get a lot right. It was held in high esteem by, for example, the Greeks. And so they picked up the ball, in a sense, and made the heart into something that was incredibly important.
Really?
So philosophers like Plato and Aristotle believed that the heart was the seat of intelligence and emotions, including love. And then their work was passed on to the ancient Romans, and that's where you get folks like Galen in the first century CE that really were incredibly influential for reasons that I found fascinating.
Absolutely. Before we get to that, there was one thing I loved as you were talking about the ancient Greeks and, again, how they picked up on some of the assumptions made by the ancient Egyptians. You tell us Aristotle regarded the heart as the hub for all of our memories and our sensory perception and so on, and Aristotle and other ancient Greeks regarded the brain as essentially like the radiator of the body. And, you know, it's so interesting to think about why they and others would leap to those kind of conclusions. And I don't remember who it is you quote in your book, but somebody who makes the point that the heart is a much more apparently alive organ in the body compared to, for instance, the brain that at a glance just seems to kind of sit there like a stone, whereas we can just tell even before the time of x-rays and so on, we know that the heart itself is alive and throbbing and moving.
Yeah.
And so it makes perfect sense that one would think that that is where everything stems from. And
sure, and it's got this central location. And you know, you can feel it speed up if you're afraid, and it slows down when you relax. So you know, it was warm. You know, when you stimulated it, it responded. So they sort of equated that to living things. You know, whether you were talking about the heart or a human, so that's where that to me is, and what historians have learned. I mean, that's really the origin of this whole concept of cardiocentrism. The brain doesn't do much at all. It's the heart.
Right. And of course, as you point out in your book, there are all kinds of figures of speech that underscore this. I mean, our language, in a sense, is heavy with all kinds of references to the heart in this respect. In fact, I just remembered, I almost forgot, somewhere right at the outset of your book, I think, you give us 7 different definitions of the word heart. And, of course, only one of them is that organ in our body. But all of these other definitions, all very commonly used, really speak to the way in which we have thought about the heart in so many different ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was an explosion in the arts, and the artists, whether they were writing literature or poetry, they just picked up on this concept that the heart was the seat of emotion, especially emotions of a romantic nature.
One of the things I wanted to be sure to talk to you about, because it really helps us understand our vast lack of knowledge about the heart and all kinds of other matters related to the human body, is something that I had not ever known about until I read your book, namely a ban on dissection of the human body that you tell us was at least largely in place for 18 centuries. And, of course, if one is not allowed to dissect the human body, then there is going to be a very, very serious limitation on what you're going to understand about the human body and its function. Explain the origins of this ban on dissection of the human body and the ultimate consequences of that.
Well, it was really a Greek, you know, this came from the Greeks and Romans. You know, there was, like, as you said, a ban on human dissection. Greek cultural traditions were it was related to this idea of the contaminating and polluting power of corpses. So that was one aspect of it. This is why you didn't want to, you know, cut a body up. And the other is this negative connotation to cut the actual cutting. You know, it was fine in warfare, but you just didn't want to do that to a human body. Cutting to human skin was a real no-no. And because of that, probably the most influential of these early physicians, and you know, Galen shows up in every one of my books for the reasons that I'm going to talk about, is the fact that Galen, who was a Roman surgeon, first century CE, he made a lot of statements about the human condition, and he wrote probably, you know, whether it was him or his followers, about 3 million words on the human condition. But he was only able to dissect animals. So a lot of what he got was wrong. And he also believed in things that he picked up from the ancient Greeks, like this, the concept of 4 humors, where you had blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. And by balancing these 4 humors, you could deal with any type of medical or problem or mental problem. You know, they would do things like they would try to bleed people who had drowned, because there's this idea that if you balanced blood, the amounts of blood in a person, that you'd be able to cure them. And his, Galen's works were, as I said, based mostly on animal dissection. And the important thing is that the 3 million words that he did write were not translated into Latin, which was at the time the language of scholarship. It was eventually translated into Arabic by Syrian Christians, and in that transition, what happened was that translation from Arabic to Latin built upon the Christian leanings of the translators. And the church fell in love with that. The Western church fell in love with that. So Galen's works were sort of declared to be divinely inspired. And you couldn't really do anything except follow what Galen had written. And that went on for centuries. Mm. And so it really put a crimp, had a devastating effect on medical advances for the next approximately 1,500 years.
You write it
one. And that's something that just shows up in all of my writings. You cannot de-emphasize how important Galen was in many cases, for all the wrong reasons.
Right. You write at one point, Galen's mistake-laden views became unchallenged medical doctrine in Europe and elsewhere for well over 1,000 years after his death. It's just staggering to think about the way in which that, in a sense, changed the way in which history unfolded. And your book is also about the efforts here and there to finally come to a little bit better understanding of how all of this works, of how the body itself functions. And you talk about various people that will be largely unknown to us, but who are important in this slow advancement. People like one William Harvey. You tell us one of the first Western scientists who really proclaimed that the human body operates like a machine, with each of the organs having its own particular function. And, of course, this is someone who died in 1657. So he had serious limitations to what he understood, but at least he understood that. And it is thanks to him and others that we begin to finally begin to develop something like an understanding of how the body functions.
Yeah, yeah. Even there, though, when, you know, this, people have heard of William Harvey, and basically the idea there is that he is the first, and you'll see the quotation marks that I'm imagining putting down right now, to discover the fact, this connection between the two sides of the heart, and that the right side of the heart pumps blood to the lungs, the blood comes back to the left side, and then the oxygenated blood gets pumped to the body. It's said that he wasn't. You know, hundreds of years earlier, there were a number of different physicians and researchers in different countries that came up with the same idea. They just didn't get the airplay in the West, as it were. There was a lot being done. But it was, you know, that sort of stuff was kept hush-hush.
Right.
Or at a certain point, you know, folks just realized that a lot of what they were, that had been listening to, had been doing and listening to for centuries was just absolutely wrong. And
right.
So there was this slow move away from Galen and the four humors.
Mm. It is in the ninth chapter of your book, which is titled What Goes In, that you tell us about a remarkable shift, thanks chiefly to Juan Andreas Libaeus, who begins to explore the notion that perhaps we shouldn't be doing this bloodletting, this purging of substances from the body in order to cure things that are a problem. Perhaps instead we should be looking in the other direction at blood transfusion, of infusing something into the body that will be helpful. Although in this book you chronicle some of the really strange early efforts in terms of transfusions, some of which were blood transfusions and some were not transfusions of blood at all, as I think you briefly mentioned earlier in the interview. Tell us more about this intriguing point in our history.
Yeah, blood was a mystery, and so when things like the first microscopes were developed, and people were looking at things under the microscope, and you looked at, for example, milk, the little globules of fat, and this is just one example, the little globules of fat that you could see under even in one of the first microscopes reminded scientists of the people who were using these microscopes of blood corpuscles and so, you know, blood cells, and so they thought that by transfusing milk into humans that they could substitute, that would be something that you would add to someone if they were having medical problems, and so they would transfuse the blood of a lamb. If the person was, had behavioral problems, they would try to chill them out by putting lamb's blood into them or calf's blood. And the other things that they would put in, as I mentioned, ale or wine. And, you know, it wasn't really until the 1900s that Carl Landsteiner figured out this idea that they're blood typing, that the fact that you just can't, even if you're transfusing blood into someone, into a patient, that there has to be a match of certain proteins on the surface of the blood cells. Otherwise, you're going to have a horrible response by the body, and that blood will be rejected. So that whole idea of incompatibility didn't come out until really late. So even when blood was begun to be transfused into people, a lot of the results were horrific, and it was sort of a crapshoot if you were actually transfusing the correct blood into somebody, because the odds were that you weren't. So it took a long time for our understanding of the ABO blood typing to allow us to make safe blood transfusions. But up until then, it was pretty much a horror show.
Wow. The third part of your book, titled From Bad to Better, explores some of the advancements that were made that thankfully, finally, allowed human beings to understand the workings of the heart. And what's so great about this part of the book is that although, you know, we can sort of understand how, of course, this is going to be where you talk about somebody figuring out how to do the pacemaker and how to do catheterization and so on, it never dawned on me that someone would have to invent something as basic as the stethoscope. And yet, of course, somebody had to invent the stethoscope. And that does not occur until the early 19th century. Explain before that how one might try to listen to the human heart, and then talk about the talented gentleman who developed this thing that eventually became the stethoscope.
Sure. The gentleman you're talking about was a French physician by the name of René Laennec, and he discovered the stethoscope in 1816. The story that you hear, and I think maybe you have to take this with a grain of salt, is that he was walking through the streets of Paris, and he saw two kids, and one of them had one of them was holding a long stick, and the other one was holding the one end of the stick up to his ear, and the kid at the other end of the stick was sort of tapping that end of the stick, and that this kid could hear that tapping through the stick, and he got the idea that of a stethoscope from that. Now, up until then, and I'll go into that early stethoscope in a minute. The problem that Laennec was encountering, and a lot of folks were encountering in Paris and elsewhere, was something that they were calling consumption. And we now know it as tuberculosis. And it wasn't until 1882 that Robert Koch figured out that there was a bacterium that caused this horrible disease, where patients were wasting away. In a sense, that's where the term consumption came from, that the body is consuming itself from within. And they had no idea in Laennec's time where consumption came from. Was it bad air? Was it, heredity? They just knew that it was a killer that would slowly waste you away. And there were, in 1816, there were really two ways to diagnose consumption, and both of them had to do with listening to the body's sounds, and one was that you would tap on the chest, and this was passed down from people that used to work in breweries, where they would check the level of fluid in the tanks in the casks that held that held beer or even wine, so they could tell how much liquid was in there. And they used the same thing, the same principle, to determine how much fluid was building up in the chests of these patients who, if it had a specific sound, they could designate that as somebody who was, coming down with consumption. The other way was to directly put your ear against the chest of a patient. And this was problematic in the 19th century, because you had things like body lice, unbathed people, the whole idea of putting of a physician putting his ear up against the breast of a woman, these were all things that were problematic. And Laennec came up with the idea of just building a simple tube that he would, one end he would place on his ear, and the other he would place on the chest of the of his patient. And really what it did was it gave physicians another tool to sort of have a baseline, you know, things like your pulse rate, and you could have a baseline to figure out what was normal, what was the normal sound of a chest that you could hear, breathing and that sort of thing, compared to somebody who was, for example, suffering from a fluid accumulation. And it became, there were all sorts of modifications of it, of course, and it's still a really valuable tool in the black bag of physicians everywhere.
Mm. In your, I believe, your 12th chapter, you talk about one Werner Forstmann, who is responsible, among other things, for helping to create developments that dramatically changed the nature of how heart surgery can be done. Explain the breakthrough for which he was responsible, and we should also probably touch on the complications that prevented him from being a continual influence in the medical world.
Sure. Well, in 1928, Werner Forstmann was a medical resident in a hospital outside of Berlin. And at the time, if you wanted to do, any type of procedure that had to do with something that you wanted to do directly to the heart, you either had to open up the chest and go into the thoracic cavity to work on the heart, or even if you were doing, if you wanted to get a specific type of treatment, medicine to the heart, you would have to inject blindly into the heart. Now, that could be disastrous if you were to hit a coronary artery, for example. And he wondered if there would be, if a way could be developed that could access the heart without having to open up the chest, and or without having to blindly deliver a hypodermic needle through the chest cavity into the heart. And he had seen a catheterization where there was these researchers had taken a catheter, a long rubber tube, and run it up through a vein in the neck of a horse into the heart to measure blood pressure inside the heart. And he thought, well, if they can do it with a horse, why can't we take a thin tube? And he used a urinary catheter. That was about that was like the perfect size. Why couldn't we run this thing through a vein? And he picked the antecubital vein, which is right in your elbow. It's almost direct link to the heart. So if you could run a catheter up through this vein, you could access the heart. You could actually get this catheter into the heart to deliver, for example, medication. And he had this idea, and everybody sort of poo-pooed it and told him, no, we can't really do that. And he convinced a nurse at the hospital that he worked at to help him. And the reason that he did, come to find out that, and she thought she was going to be the patient, that, and she thought it was a good idea, and he was going to run this catheter through, up her arm into her heart, and then they were going to put her under a fluoroscope and actually see this in real time. But the real reason that he contacted her was because she had the key to the cabinet that had the urinary catheters. So he convinces her to this happens late at night, to get the catheters. They go to the a lab, and he says, "Well, I like to strap you down so you don't move." And so can you just imagine this nurse being strapped down to a chair, and then he disappears, and she's got to be wondering what did I get myself into. And he comes back several minutes later, and he's got the catheter in his own arm. And now he says, can you help me here? So he basically unties her, and they sneak into the fluoroscopy room, and they set him up on this fluoroscope, and they take, they literally can record the catheter as he's moving it towards his own heart. So long story short, this was the first successful use of a cardiac catheter. And originally, he got hammered for it by the administration in his hospital, because they didn't like all the publicity that this young man was getting. And he got fired from that hospital, got another job. And eventually, years later, when World War II came around, he had an affiliation with the Nazi Party. And this was really his, you know, when we think about this type of thing, you always see this asterisk about after his name. And it tells the fact that, yes, you know, he was a Nazi. People have done research on this, found out that he was not, you know, it was a party affiliation only. Otherwise, you know, he might have been thrown in jail. But he didn't really, there was no record that he had done any type of experimentation on people or ever did anything that except sort of help people. And meanwhile, because of this, after the war, a lot of other folks who picked up that technique were getting the acclaim. And he was, he was relegated to sort of, not getting the credit that he deserved. And years later, he finally won the Nobel Prize. So he was, recognized for this major, major contribution.
Well, your book, of course, goes on to explore all kinds of other fascinating matters, including the whole notion of heart transplants and valve replacements and so on. And it is technology that we don't exactly take for granted, but your book helps us understand the painstaking advancements that were necessary to make these kind of treatments and interventions possible. And we haven't even really explored sufficiently the whole opening section of your book, in which you tell us about all kinds of amazing variation in the hearts that we find in the animal kingdom. I mean, everything from squids and octopuses to horseshoe crabs, and including those strange creatures that seem to not have any hearts whatsoever. And it's just an endlessly fascinating book. I mean, I knew it would be interesting, but it exceeded all of my expectations in every respect. And I should think maybe for you, as you explored it as well, you probably came to realize this is an even more fascinating topic than you realized at the outset.
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I said earlier, I was a little bit iffy with that topic, because I've been into material that was pretty much a bit weirder than the heart. But when I started to look across the animal kingdom at all of these fascinating creatures, and the fact that so many of them, and the ones that I picked, I tried to go with ones with animals that not only had interesting hearts and circulatory systems, but also had medical relevance. And so once I started to go through that list, that's when the book really took off for me.
Wow. Well, it is so interesting. And again, it's titled Pump, A Natural History of the Heart. And it's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and its author, Bill Shutt. Bill Shutt, I congratulate you on a job well done. This is an interesting book in so many ways, and I hope many people will seek it out. I'm glad that I did, and I'm so glad that we had the opportunity to talk about it today on the morning show. Thank you so much, and best wishes to you.
You too. Take care, and happy holidays to you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, a really interesting conversation about free speech. Are we granted truly unlimited right to free speech by the U.S. Constitution? Dennis Barron examines that question in a book called You Can Always Say What You Want, The Paradox of Free Speech. Our interview includes an extensive conversation about Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter and some of the changes which he has made there. On Wednesday, John Schlimm, author of What Would Gen Z Do? Everything You Don't Know About Gen Z, But Should, Also, I hope that Wednesday morning show will include a conversation with a wonderful young local musician by the name of Joey Bilotti, talking about his new music group and the new Christmas single that they have just released. On Thursday, Fiona Carnarvon, known as the Countess of Carnarvon, and talking about her new book, The Earl and the Pharaoh, From the Real Downtown Downton Abbey to the Discovery of Tutankhamun. Her husband is the Earl of Carnarvon, and one of his ancestors had a very direct hand in the discovery of King Tut's tomb 100 years ago. This book is an examination of his very, very fascinating life. That'll be coming up on Thursday's morning show. And a reminder that through the holiday break, when the WGTD studios are closed, you can still enjoy the morning show by subscribing to the podcast.